The stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to the 11th episode of Podcast of the Dragon. Can you want to murder someone and admire them and feel sorry for them at the same time? You can if it's Rand Bloody Al Thor. At the start of the Great Hunt, he's such a man alone, they might as well call him Onaline. Knowing he can channel is giving him a massive psychological owie, and the fact that Moraine won't kiss it and make it better is making him feel real, real butthurt. I don't precisely have a favorite Wheel of Time book, because my favorite things about the Wheel of Time are point of view and the characters and the relationships between them. Instead, I have favorite books for each character. My favorite Rand book is The Great Hunt. It's a single book where he knows that he can channel, but he isn't yet the dragon. And he has all the fear and anticipation of despair and horror that awaits him due to the reality of channeling, but the taint isn't yet affecting his mind. I first read The Great Hunt when I was 15, which wasn't long after my own mental health issues really started taking off with a vengeance. With bipolar disorder, you deal with both mania and depression, and while I recall always struggling with the second, it's not uncommon for the first to wait until you're well into puberty to start kicking in. A common popular culture idea of mania is being super up and pumped and like top of the world happy, but that has rarely ever been my experience. I get the hysterical, like, laughing and crying at the same time, like anxiety to the nth degree type instead. And being a rapid cycler, before I was medicated, my mood could change 24 times in 2 minutes. In Chronosaurs, we get Perrin describing certain male channelers by smell, particularly Rand and Dasheva, and how their moods change so suddenly, and it creeps him out because he's a stable person, and the idea that someone could feel so many feelings so suddenly and have them change so rapidly unnerves him. As a teenager, that was my life. And I didn't think about it until looking back and pondering my early experience of the Wheel of Time for the purpose of talking about it on this podcast, that what was probably very helpful for me in dealing with my own mental health issues, because seeing a character struggle with his own sanity and seeing Rand draw on his own native stubbornness and dig deep to try and cope with it and keep going and not let it drag him under, it was almost like having a role model to identify with, like being able to read the point of view of someone who knew what it was like to struggle or to feel like you're slipping. That was unique. There was nothing else out there that I could read that could so articulately depict mental illness from the point of view of someone who is just caught up in watching everything just spin out of control. And not just that, but refusing to give into it, or refusing to give it into everything that is falling apart within himself. Because it's not just that Rand's going crazy or that he's doomed to go crazy. Everything is doomed to go crazy because the whole world in the Wheel of Time is going crazy. I remember just pushing my way through the day by pure will, like getting through school so I could come home and disappear into the Wheel of Time, where so many of the out-of-control things that the characters were struggling against manifested as things that could actually be fought. RJ imbues Rand with this gritty determination, just pure stubbornness, what they call the stony soil of the Two Rivers, which even though Rand is not Two Rivers blood, being raised there, it's part of him that he is able to cling to, even when he is in his worst mental states. Or Jordan will describe like that he's holding on to things by his fingernails, and that spoke to me so clearly as a kid. It spoke to me so well because there were so many times where it felt like I was holding on by my fingernails, just barely getting through, and being able to slip away into the wheel of time and live one's and being able to slip away into the wheel of time and live in someone else's crazy instead was nice. In a series where Robert Jordan explores insanity and stress and strain and trauma in a very thoughtful and frankly very realistic fashion, it was really relevant at a time of my life when my own issues were very new. And so there's a certain nostalgia to reading, particularly to reading The Great Hunt. Because I feel for Rand, like his sadness and his dread and his loneliness and that sense of just being utterly lost. I remember being 15 and feeling all of those things and reading The Great Hunt for the first time and being able to identify so strongly with Rand. And the fact that Rand is able to go on and take on the responsibility of being the dragon and do that and not break from it. And another thing about the Wheel of Time that was always encouraging is that people rise to occasions that they fear will break them. And so it always left me wondering, will I be able to rise to the difficult things in my own life? This next hardship, this next blow, this next entry on my 2020 bingo card, this looks like it might be too much. But nothing that I have ever faced has been too much. And I sometimes wonder if one reason for that is because when I was young and emotionally fragile and needed it most, I had this book series be so much a part of me, with characters facing issues very similar to the issues that I was facing in situations that don't totally carry them under because they refused to let it. And it means a lot to me. Because there is something to be said for just having someone you can identify with. And so as much as his issues with toxic masculinity make me want to pinch his nostrils shut and put my hand over his mouth later on, Rand, when he knows that he has this mental illness that is channeling something inside his mind that's going to kill him, that's very grim. It's very grim for him, because a male channeler, it's like you basically have a mental illness that means you're doomed to die. And that's fucked up. And there are people who struggle with mental illness that do feel like they're doomed to die, which is a terrible, terrible thing to feel. And, I mean, I did go through a period of time as a teenager where I did feel that way. And it's awful. And so knowing that sense of dread and inevitability, it makes it easy to identify with Rand, and it also makes this book, Before the Taint, works on Rand's head enough to where he starts to begin to be borderline psychotic, and also before he just has to worry about more than himself and his immediate friends. This is the book where Rand really tugs on my heart, and so it is definitely my favorite, or at least it's my favorite for Rand. We begin The Great Hunt with the Emmonsfielders mentally and emotionally splitting away from each other. They've been in Faldara for a month, so they've had several weeks of normalcy where they get to sleep all night, wake up in real beds in the morning, eat delicious meals on a regular basis, have pleasant conversation with very pleasant and polite people, basically several weeks where their trauma can come calling. Perrin, in particular, has been drawing apart even longer. He's been drawing apart since he and Egwene were rescued from the White Cloaks. Rand makes particular notice of it when the party finally rejoins together in Camelon, and Matt actually makes a comment to Rand that Perrin is making him nervous because he's being so strange. So Perrin's been withdrawing. He started even earlier because he also feels dirty. He's got his sense of being tainted. And in a way, the wolves make Perrin as concerned for his sanity as Rand is concerned for his own, because losing yourself the way that he did is a form of losing your mind. It's very different from the kind of disintegration that Cydeen causes, but it is still a loss of yourself. and being in a place where he's surrounded by lots of people, lots of very polite and proper people with a very different culture from what he's used to, Perrin is painfully self-conscious. We don't get much from his point of view, but the little that we do get, it's very clear that he is super self-conscious. Matt is engaged in avoidance, as he does, and is dealing with everything by gambling and having fun, which it's not an unhealthy way to cope, as long as he's not problem gambling, and the nice thing about not having very much money and having an Aes Sedai who's got fat sacks of gold basically paying your way is that if you gamble all your coppers away, you're good to go. I mean, I suppose someone might deal out this farm boy credit, but Shiner and menials aren't going to be able to front him enough to get him in trouble, so he's probably doing the best of any of them. With Rand and Perrin both distracted, Matt finds other ways to focus on fun, because his normal go-to fun friends aren't very fun right now. Nynaeve is coping with an identity crisis. She was willing to let her heart kind of get away with her to the point where she actually made an effort and reached out to Lon and was like, I'd be willing to marry you even though a wisdom seldom weds. And to be willing to do that and to reach out to someone who is bonded to a chick whose guts you hate, which is a huge complication. It's not exactly like he's dating someone else, but it's almost like he's in a sort of companionate marriage, and she has no reason to expect that this other woman who she can't stand is going to fuck off, but she was obviously willing to try to figure something out in order to be with this guy. She knows nothing of the One Power yet and has no reason to believe he can be released from the bond, so she was willing to make that kind of effort and have a conversation with him, which is a lot for Nynaeve to do, and whatever my issues with her, I give her mad respect for that, and so for him to shut her down for a dumb reason, and maybe it's not fair to say that Lon's reasons are dumb. If you're someone who's basically doomed to die because you're constantly fighting and you aren't even going to be together because she's going off to the White Tower, long-distance relationships aren't particularly feasible in a time without phones or the internet. It's one thing if you've got something established, but one conversation over an undrunk cup of tea doesn't really count. And you know, in certain situations, like in our world, say when you're dating in high school and the one of you is going off to the army, the smart thing to do there is to break up. So maybe it's not totally a dumb thing that Lon tells her no. But Nynaeve's coping with the fact that she actually made an effort and reached out to him and he shut her down. So she's not the wisdom anymore, and she's trying to figure out what that means for herself. She's decided she's going to be an Aes Sedai, even though she hates Aes Sedai and hates the very thought of it. And she's trying to get her head around the idea that she might actually want to get married or have a relationship or be anything other than what she once thought that she could be. She's expanding her vision of herself. Egwene is trying to cope with her shit by focusing on a problem. She'd like to help Rand, but he's been avoiding her. Perrin is avoiding everyone, and Matt's problem is beyond her. So she focuses on helping Pat and Fain. And for people who want to talk about her stupidity with that, that was a plot device to get the dagger to the dungeon. And honestly, a really good one, because I feel like it was one of the only ways to be able to get Matt into Fain's path so that Fain could steal the dagger where Matt would not end up dead, was the way that RJ set that up. That was one of the only ways he could pull that off. So I feel like blaming Egwene for being dumb isn't quite fair. It's not like Fain is a stranger. Their relationship is something that you can kind of imagine off screen. She's known him for years, and it makes sense for her to visit him. There's not a lot for Egwene to do in Faldara, and she can't relate to a lot of the Shineran women. She's really uncomfortable, even after a month, having someone fold her clothes and pack up her shit and basically treat her like a noble. She's just, like, she feels like a fish out of water there, and so I think she probably spends a lot of time reading books, which I'm sure she enjoys having access to more books than she's used to, and trying to not dwell on all the terrible shit that happened to her over the last couple months, but by focusing on helping someone else, and when Rand is accusing Nynaeve, like, you know, Fain's dangerous and you guys never talked to Moraine about it, Nynaeve was like, You know, she was studying to be a wisdom, and part of that is a desire to heal, and people can't want to come back to the light, and because nobody knows exactly the level of Fane's internal fuckery at that point, it's not an unreasonable thing when Fane says that he hates the Dark One and he wants to come back to the light for Egwene to want to try to help him with that. Rand understandably feels very alone. There is almost no one that he can talk to. Of his 7 companions, 4 of them know that he can channel. It says, Lan knew, and Moraine, and Egwene and Nynaeve. He wished none of them knew, and most of all he wished Egwene did not, but at least Matt and Perrin, and Loyal too, believed he was still the same. He thought he would rather die than let them know, than see the hesitation and worry he sometimes caught in Egwene's eyes and Nynaeve's even when they were trying their best. Rand comes from a culture where people discuss their shit along gendered lines, but he can't talk to his 2 bros about what's eating at him. And while Loyal would probably not be nearly as afraid or as judgmental, the Ogier have reasons to fear male channelers, like they've seen how the taint polluted the ways and how because of it there's Mach and Shin. So they know what male channelers have wrought on the world, however inadvertent. The very reason that they're tied to their steading is due to the taint on Sidene. If not for the breaking, the longing wouldn't be a thing, and Loyal wouldn't have a ticking clock inside him leading toward permanent disability or death if he stays out too long. But despite that, I don't see Loyal as capable of being afraid of Rand no matter what, certainly not the person he is now. And we know that when he finds out what Rand is, he doesn't ever seem particularly perturbed by it. He's just like, oh my god, he's even more Ta'veren than I thought he was. That's amazing. But Rand, still, you know, he can't trust his discretion, and the idea of actually telling anybody makes him want to shrivel up and die. And so even though Nynaeve and Egwene know about it, even if he were comfortable having regular conversations with them about anything that's troubling him, the hesitation he describes in their eyes makes it very difficult to talk to them. When Lan is asking Rand why he hasn't left yet, he's like, you know, you said a month ago you were going to leave, and like 3 weeks ago I thought you'd be gone. Why are you still here? Matt and Perrin are still here, Rand mumbled. I don't want to leave before they do. I might not see them again for years, maybe. His head dropped back against the wall. Blood and ashes. At least they just think I'm crazy not to go home with them. Half the time Nynaeve looks at me like I'm 6 years old and I've skinned my knee and she's going to make it better. The other half she looks like she's seeing a stranger, one she might offend if she looks too closely at that. She's a wisdom, and besides that, I don't think she's ever been afraid of anything, but she... He shook his head. And Egwene. Burn me. She knows why I have to go, but every time I mention it, she looks at me and I nod up inside and... He closed his eyes, pressing the sword hilt against his forehead as if he could press what he was thinking out of existence. And so, Rand is left with only Lan to talk to. And Lan admittedly rises to the occasion. He is kind to him, he trains him, and above all, he treats him no differently than he did before. Maybe a little bit differently, in the sense that he's even nicer to him than he was before. He had been a little bit gruff with him, and maybe a little impatient with him throughout the beginning parts of the Eye of the World. And even after they were reunited in Camelon, he still didn't have quite that warm sense of familiarity. Once they're at the Eye of the World, and Rand fights Aghanor and Ashamael, and when he comes back and he's talking to Moraine and Nynaeve and Egwene, the others come out of the cavern where the eye was, carrying the artifacts, and Lan sees Rand. "Good to see you alive, sheepherder," Lan said gruffly. "I see you hung on to your sword. Maybe you'll learn to use it now." Rand felt a sudden burst of affection for the warder. Lan knew, but on the surface at least nothing had changed. He thought that perhaps for Lan nothing had changed inside either. I think Lan can really identify with Rand in a lot of ways. Lan exists in a very narrow world. He has a very grim fate. He's burdened by duty. He's just denied himself love because he feels like the duty that he has for himself and the fate that he feels like he's consigned to means that it's not fair of him to tie himself to Nynaeve that way. And so I think that he sees himself in Rand, or he sees Rand in himself, And knowing what Rand is, obviously he sees value in him for that reason, because Lon has been sworn from birth to stand against the Shadow, and Rand was born for that very purpose. Now that they've been spending all of this time together, and Lon has been training him to use his sword, and just being able to sympathize with him more and more, he's really been Rand's one true friend, the one who knows what's going on with him and listens to him and is truly kind to him and treating him no differently and making him feel like he's anchored and like he has an ally. So of everyone, Lon is the one who really makes him feel like he's not totally alone, because he has one more companion who knows that he can channel, but she doesn't count because Moraine isn't talking to him. What makes Moraine choosing not to speak to Rand throughout his time at Faldara, or just refusing to see him when he goes to talk to her, and I took her to task about that last episode, what makes it especially kind of cold and dickish is partly just the fact that it contrasts so sharply with the kind way that she deals with him at the Eye. She's very unperturbed with his channeling, or she talks to him about it in a very unperturbed fashion. How she feels about it on the inside is a little different. RJ, when he shows women talking or thinking about male channeling, it always seems a little bit dramatic, the way they just, like, shudder and feel literally sick to their stomachs at the thought of a man channeling. It's like, does he not really know how women react to things? Like, I can't imagine something that would make women so viscerally repulsed like that, except maybe spiders, or some women don't like snakes. And then I tried to think, you know, well, maybe he's going by the way, like, straight men of a certain age and origin feel about gay guys or something. And that's what he was trying to, like, imagine. Okay, well, maybe this is the way that women would feel about male channelers. And since the way that straight men of a certain age and origin react so dramatically in being repulsed by gay guys, it's, like, so absurd that I have a hard time picturing it actually being genuine. Like, I know that it is genuine, but it's, like, so over the top. But so when he's showing women who are so repelled by male channelers, that's the only comparison that I can imagine. Regardless, Moraine deals with Rand kindly, whatever her internal feelings about his channeling. So she describes to him what was going on. She tells him about how he cleansed Bella's tiredness the first time he channeled. She says, "You needed something more than you had ever needed anything before in your life, and you reached out to the one thing that could give it to you, Sidene." He shivered. He felt so cold, his fingers hurt. "If I never do it again, if I never touch it again, I won't—" he could not say it. "Go mad, turn the land and people around him to madness, die, rotting while he still lived." "Perhaps," Moraine said. "It would be much easier if there was someone to teach you, but it might be done with a supreme effort of will. You can teach me. Surely you—" He stopped when the Aes Sedai shook her head. "Can a cat teach a dog to climb trees, Rand? Can a fish teach a bird to swim? I know Sidar, but I can teach you nothing of Sidene. Those who could are 3,000 years dead. Perhaps you were stubborn enough, though. Perhaps your will is strong enough." However distressed he was in that moment, because he was angry with her. He's angry, he has his outbursts about her wanting to gentle him, and it's like, you know, Balzamon, he told me about a whole bunch of false dragons and stuff like that. You know, once he had a little time to get his head around all of that and calm down, he wanted advice and comfort from Moraine. And since she dealt with him so kindly, she didn't treat him any differently, it's like, here is this one other person besides her warder that he can actually turn to feel safe and like he's not a complete monster. And who can, you know, even if she can't teach him how to channel, even if she can't do any of those things, she could at least be a shoulder to cry on, like be something for him. But a week afterwards, they're in Faldara and the bells are ringing and Rand says that he's going to leave and Egwene is like, oh, Moraine probably won't like that. And he's like, she doesn't know I'm alive. She doesn't talk to me when I go to her. And so the Great Hunt begins 3 weeks after that with Rand not just frightened of his future, not just dragging his feet against that tearing inside, that permanent separation from his friends, his loved ones. He loves his friends. You know, Two Rivers bros aren't the type of guys who are like, man, I love you, but he loves them. And they're just, There's just this ensuing grief once he leaves them behind forever and goes to be alone. He's depressed and miserable, and he is super butthurt and really confused because Moraine is ignoring him. He's hurt by that. As Alon is trying to figure out why he is staying around, he says, "And that is all the reason? You want to spend as much time as you can with your friends from home before they go? That's why you're dragging your feet? You know what's sniffing at your heels." Rand searched angrily to his feet. "All right, it's Moraine. I wouldn't even be here if not for her, and she won't as much as talk to me. She tells me horrible things about myself." His knuckles whitened on the sword. "That I'm going to go mad and die. And then suddenly she won't even say two words to me. She acts as if I'm no different than the day she found me, and that smells wrong, too." "You want her to treat you like what you are?" "No, I don't mean that. Burn me, I don't know what I mean half the time. I don't want that, and I'm scared of the other. Now she's gone off somewhere, vanished, without telling anybody where she was going or when she'd be back, or even if she would be back. She has to be able to tell me something to help me, Lon. Something. She has to. If she ever comes back..." "She's back," Sheepherder, "last night. But I think she has told you all she can. Be satisfied. You've learned what you can from her." I don't know that Moraine is actually telling Rand, "Yo, you're gonna go mad and die." I think maybe it's just that because Rand knows that, he can channel, he knows that that's his fate. And the fact that he's trying to talk to Moraine and isn't getting anything from her, it's like, it's all well and good to be like, she can't give you any more information about channeling the male half of the power. That's fine. But advice or comfort or something, that's really what Rand is looking for. He just wants somebody who has knowledge and smarts. Maybe even just a woman. You know, his mother died when he was 5, and Moraine, she's technically old enough to be his mom. My research looking at the Wheel of Time companion, his mom was quite a bit older than Moraine, probably at least 10 or 12 years older, but the point is, while Moraine is certainly not someone that you would ever call motherly, she's definitely someone that could be older sisterly, and Rand wants some kind of comfort. Some kind of comfort from someone who could give it to him and he could actually believe it. He can't believe it coming from Nynaeve or Egwene, but he could believe it coming from Moraine. And she's ignoring him. And he's really hurt by it. And maybe her method of keeping him in the keep by ignoring him is working. But being Tavirin would have kept him in the keep. And you know, Moraine tells Swan, when Swan is bitching at her about going against the plan, that the pattern pays no heed to human plans. But then she tries to force things anyway, and in doing so, she makes this poor kid so sad and miserable when he's already really sad and miserable. And Lon is probing to find out why Rand hasn't left yet, which I don't think he's doing at Moraine's bidding. I think he's genuinely curious, because Rand keeps saying that he's going to go. And I think maybe it's kind of like similar to when Matt kept saying that he was going to leave the Stone of Tyr, and he wanted to leave, but he kept calling him back, because it was just sort of the pattern wasn't going to let him leave yet. Rand lists a desire to learn how to use his sword because he wants to be better at using it in case he really needs to, and a desire to be near Matt and Perrin because they haven't left yet, and the last of utmost importance, just a desire for Moraine to make it all okay. But Moraine can't make it okay. Rand is naive enough to desperately want someone older and wiser to fix it. But things are fucked up, and that's beyond Moraine's control. She can't help the taint. She can't help his fate. And she doesn't have the time to pat him on the back and say, "There, there," when the Forsaken have been freed and one of the seals on the Dark One's prison is already broken. She has to whip him into shape and get him to where he can function as the dragon, not just someone who possesses raw power, but someone competent, with authority in his bearing, someone people can follow, a dragon who can effectively fight the shadow. He's looking for a comforting older sister, and what he needs is a drill sergeant, and he's upset about that. The whole of the Great Hunt involves Moraine not being there for Rand. She's either not there physically, or else she's not talking to him, she's not available emotionally. She shows up at the end, once they're on Toman Head and he's had his battle with Ashamael, and then she finally starts communicating with him. But beyond the scene where he's being bushwhacked by Her, Varen, and the Amyrlin Sea, that horrible, uncomfortable meeting where they're like, "You're the Dragon Reborn, and we're going to tell you in the shittiest way we possibly can by making you feel all emotionally off balance because we're dicks." Beyond that, she barely talks to him at all. She is kind to him maybe once when Egwene and Matt are injured, and other than that, she is only playing games in an attempt to try to whip him into shape. She's, you know, she's being a drill sergeant with someone who doesn't want to be in the army. And until she shows up again at the end of the book, this is the book where Moraine is absent for Rand. And then in the next book is the book where Rand is absent for Moraine. And I don't know if he's giving her tit for tat or what, but, you know. But RJ makes sure to fill this book with Rand being nearly constantly angry with her and having these bitter ruminations where he's pissed at her for what she's not doing right. For stealing his coats, for pushing him into a position of leadership, for all of this kind of stuff, and wanting to be away from her and away from the control of the Aes Sedai, and then simultaneously missing her and wanting her advice and wishing that she was with him, and then thinking that he's nuts to want her with him. It's almost like Moraine is really bad at being the parent of a teenager, and Rand is a teenager who's constantly mentally calling her out for it. And because so many otherwise skilled parents are bad at parenting teenagers, there's a lot of realism to that. Lots of people are good at parenting until their kids become teenagers, and then they suck at it. Rand and Moraine's relationship is so complicated, which is one of the things that makes it interesting. While Rand is venting to Lon about how upsetting he finds Moraine's silent treatment, they get a great view of the party from Tar Valon coming into Fal'Dara. They see the soldiers and the Aes Sedai and all of the musicians as they're all marching up into the town and approaching the keep. Rand gets really freaked out, understandably so, because he doesn't know why the fuck they've shown up and there are a ton of them. It says, "The Amyrlin Seats come in person." Lon looked at them, his expression as hard and unreadable as a rock. "Your lessons are done, sheepherder." He paused then, and Rand almost thought there was sympathy on his face. That could not be, of course. Better for you if you were a week gone. With that, the warder snatched up his shirt and disappeared down the ladder into the tower. Rand worked his mouth, trying to get a little moisture. He stared at the column approaching Fal'Dara as if it really were a snake, a deadly viper. The drums and trumpets sang loud in his ears. The Amyrlin Seat, who ordered the Aes Sedai. "She's come because of me." He could think of no other reason. They knew things, had knowledge that could help him, he was sure, and he did not dare ask any of them. He was afraid they had come to gentle him. "And afraid they haven't, too," he admitted reluctantly. "Light, I don't know which scares me more." "I didn't mean to channel the power," he whispered. "It was an accident. Light, I don't want anything to do with it. I swear I'll never touch it again. I swear it." With a start, he realized that the Aes Sedai party was entering the city gates. The wind swirled up fiercely, chilling his sweat like droplets of ice, making the trumpets sound like sly laughter. He thought he could smell an opened grave strong in the air. "My grave, if I keep standing here." Grabbing his shirt, he scrabbled down the ladder and began to run. So Rand goes to run. He's panicking. He gets into his room, and it's filled with all the serving women who are getting rid of all of his clothes and putting the new clothes in the wardrobe. And that's convenient timing for literary purposes, and logical in the sense that it would take time in a town as small as Fal'Dara for the tailors to make all the new clothing. So he's going to get dressed, and he's looking at all the beautiful fancy coats and shirts and breeches, and he sees that he's got two cloaks. Two, when he had made do with one at a time all his life. One cloak was plain stout wool and dark green, the other deep blue with a stiff standing collar embroidered in gold herons, and high on the left breast where a lord would wear his sign. His hand drifted to the cloak of its own accord, as if uncertain what they would feel, His fingers brushed the stitching of a serpent curled almost into a circle, but a serpent with four legs and a lion's golden mane, scaled in crimson and gold, its feet each tipped with five golden claws. His hand jerked back as if burned. Light, help me! Was it Amelisa had this made, or Moraine? How many saw it? How many know what it is, what it means? Even one is too many. Burn me, she's trying to get me killed. Bloody Moraine won't even talk to me, but now she's given me bloody fine new clothes to die in. Rand packs up his shit and then runs around the keep with this sense of desperation, trying to get out. And he can't get out because the mystery order comes down that shuts down the stables and shuts the gates. The order that I think Moraine put out when she saw that the Ammerlin was coming, because she knew Rand would run to his room, grab his things, and go. And I always kind of see him, because he already feels so sad and depressed and alone and desperate. And now you get to the point where he's running and he feels anxious along with everything else. And it just, it's a lovely, like, extra little mix to his whole, like, mental health cocktail. And he's been turned down from the stable. He can't get his horse. Regana Massima won't let him out of the gate. And he's walking all over the place. He's looking to see if he can't climb a wall, like, trying to find alternative ways out. And then it says, suddenly he felt weary to the bone, drained. The Ammerlin seat was there, and there was no way out. No way out, and the Ammerlin seat there. If she knew he was there, if she had sent the wind that had seized him, then she was already hunting him with an Aes Sedai's powers. Rabbits had more chance against his bow. He refused to give up, though. There were those who said Two Rivers folk could teach stones and give lessons to mules. When there was nothing else left, Two Rivers people hung on to their stubbornness. Leaving the wall, he wandered through the keep. He paid no mind to where he went, so long as it was nowhere he would be expected. Not anywhere near his room, nor any of the stables, nor any gate. Nassima might risk Uno's tongue to report him trying to leave, nor Garden. All he could think of was keeping away from any Aes Sedai, even Moraine. She knew about him, despite that she had done nothing against him. So far as you know. What if she's changed her mind? Maybe she sent for the Ammerlin seat. For a moment, feeling lost, he leaned against the corridor wall, the stone hard under his shoulder. Eyes blank, he stared at a distant nothing and saw things he did not want to see. Gentled, would it be so bad to have it all over? Really over? He closed his eyes, but he could still see himself huddling like a rabbit with nowhere left to run, and Aes Sedai closing round him like ravens. They almost always die soon after, men who've been gentled. They stop wanting to live. He remembered Tom Marilyn's words too well to face that. With a brisk shake, he hurried on down the hall. No need to stay in one place until he was found. How long till they find you anyway? You're like a sheep in a pen. How long? He touched the sword hilt at his side. No, not a sheep. Not for Aes Sedai or anybody else. He felt a little foolish but determined. If there's one quality I can attribute more than any other to Rand, it's that sense of determination. I didn't start being medicated for my mental illness until I was 18, and it had really kicked into full swing by the time I was 15. So I had 3 years where I was in a lot of trouble. And reading and rereading this book, because I read these books constantly during those 3 years and after. Book 5 came out the fall I was 16, about 10 months after I started reading this series, and book 6 came out a year after that. And it's almost like that moment where he's just kind of leaning against the wall for a second and thinking about giving up. Because you have those moments where you're just overwhelmed and you think about giving up. And, you know, I had a lot of moments as a teenager where I thought about giving up. And the ability to dig deep no matter what, even wondering if maybe it might be better to just have it all be over, because the constant running from everything is so exhausting. Rand's journey is exhausting, but the grit and the determination that is within him makes him so admirable. And he is a character that is deeply flawed. He does things that are foolish. He does some things that are terrible. And he suffers from toxic masculinity in some of the worst ways. There are so many things that he makes so much harder for himself because he holds it all inside. But his resolve to keep going, no matter what, makes him so inspiring. And as much as I love Eye of the World Rand because he is frightened and running from giant scary forces and trying to cope on his own with things that are overwhelming and managing really well and rising to the occasion, the Great Hunt Rand is dealing with both external and internal forces. And the worst thing about his situation is partly that the real enemy is within, and being able to identify so strongly with him and to be able to take hope from his ability to keep going no matter what. I really love Rand in this book. One of the reasons why I think that The Great Hunt is one of the best books is purely for the person that Rand is in this book, where he is bitter and angry and frightened and struggling and not crazy yet, but facing a terrible fate and not giving up. And he's not the dragon yet. While it's exasperating that he's refusing to accept it, it does give him a whole book where he can mostly be an ordinary man who can channel with all the bullshit that that entails. And his courage and his grit and his determination make him a truly admirable person. And he's the type of person that in the end you want to be your hero because he is good and sweet and fundamentally kind. And the scene with him against the wall where he's wondering if it might be better to just have it all be over. I sometimes think in many ways that scene is one of the lowest points in the whole series, because it's sort of like, at that point, he's almost the closest to giving up that he is anywhere else before he digs deep and determines to keep going. As anyone with depression can tell you, feeling sad, lost, alone, full of dread for the future, and unsupported by the person you most want to be able to count on can fill you with inertia. And Rand is suffering hardcore from inertia. So it's good that the Amaranth shows up and forces things to a head. He dragged his feet until the last possible minute, and then the pattern finally forced an action out of him. There was a convergence of events. And this is the kind of thing that we see happen time and again throughout the series. His flight response gets triggered, which sends him into a state of emotional agitation. As he's running around like crazy, after he's figured out he's not going to be able to get out of the keep, and so he's just keeping moving, trying to stay out of any Aes Sedai's sight, he comes across his friends. They're in a storeroom, Matt's dicing, and Perrin and Loyal are there, and Rand is desperate enough that he grabs Loyal and says, "Oh shit, you guys built Faldara, do you know a way out, you know, do you know a drainpipe or whatever?" And Loyal is like, "Whoa, we built Mephal de Darnel, and that place got razed in the Trolloc Wars," and then Rand's just like, "Fuck." He's like, "Fuck, I've gotta get out. And because Rand's misery and desperation is so palpable, Loyal's just sort of like, "Hey, you know, I think Rand's sick." And Matt and Perrin come over. And Rand says, "I'm not sick. I just need to get out of here. The Amaranth seed is here. Lon said, he said with her here, it would have been better for me if I were gone a week. I need to leave, and all the gates are barred." "He said that?" Matt frowned. "I don't understand. He'd never say anything against an Aes Sedai. Why now?" "Look, Rand, I don't like Aes Sedai any more than you do, but they aren't going to do anything to us." He lowered his voice to say that and looked over his shoulder to see if any of the gamblers was listening. Feared the Aes Sedai might be, but in the Borderlands they were far from being hated, and a disrespectful comment about them could land you in a fight or worse. "Look at Moraine. She isn't so bad, even if she is Aes Sedai. You're thinking like old Sen Bui telling his tall tales back home in the Winespring Inn. I mean, she hasn't hurt us, and they won't. Why would they?" Perrin's eyes lifted, yellow eyes gleaming in the dim light like burnished gold. "Moraine hasn't hurt us," Rand thought. Perrin's eyes had been as deep a brown as Matt's when they left the Two Rivers. Rand had no idea how the change had come about. Perrin did not want to talk about it, or about very much of anything since it happened, but it had come at the same time as the slump in his shoulders and a distance in his manner, as if he felt alone even with friends around him. Perrin's eyes and Matt's dagger. Neither would have happened if they had not left Emmett's field and it was Moraine who had taken them away. He knew that was not fair. They would probably all be dead at Trolloc's hands, and a good part of Emmett's field as well if she had not come to their village. But that did not make Perrin laugh the way he used to, or take the dagger from Matt's belt. And me, if I was home and still alive, would I still be what I am now? At least I wouldn't be worrying about what the Aes Sedai are going to do to me. At least Rand is aware that he can't really blame Moraine for his situation. But he's justifiably upset and hurt. I think that Rand's hurt feelers, I think that that's fair, you know? You know, he's a kid, and he's just used to gentler treatment. So I think that it's fair that he's got hurt feelers. I also think that it's fair that Moraine isn't taking responsibility for his hurt feelers. She isn't here to coddle him, and she's looking at the bigger picture. But I think that it's fair that he has them. Rand's friends sense his fear and desperation as he tells them about the Watcher that he keeps feeling coming after him as he's been walking around looking for a way out. And I don't know if that's the gray man that Inktar let into the keep, or if he's already starting to feel paranoid for the couple of times that he's used Sidheen. And he tells them about the wind that's the tiny bubble of evil that caught him on the tower top, and he's just, that he needs to leave, he needs to get out, he's just panic is in his voice. And Matt, who has such a powerfully ingrained sense of connectedness and affection for Rand, which I explored in my episode Promises in the Dark, that even though Matt's memory of the time between Whitebridge and Camelin when he and Rand were by themselves on the road is basically gone because of the dagger, his emotions for Rand, which are based on the things that happened, still exist. And so he is deeply attached to Rand, and he loves him very much, very powerfully, because of the way that Rand took care of him and stood by him and would have died rather than leave him. Matt is ready to drop everything to go with him. But instead, Rand tells him to fuck off. "But if the gates are barred," Matt said, "how do we get out?" Rand stared at him. "We?" He had to go alone. It would be dangerous for anyone near him eventually. He would be dangerous, and even Moraine could not tell him how long he had. "Matt, you know you have to go to Tarvalen with Moraine. She said that's the only place you can be separated from that bloody dagger without dying, and you know what will happen if you keep it." And while Matt proceeds to rattle off a whole bunch of stupid sayings, he's basically like, "Well, maybe I don't want to go." You know, he's really dumb in the way that he says it. And Rand lashes out, just like, "I'm gonna go by myself, people here think I'm a lord, and I like that, and I don't want you guys around, you need to fuck off," and he hurts their feelings. And it's almost like what hurts the most is him saying that he doesn't want them to go with him. Because when he apologizes to Perrin later, and Perrin says, "You didn't mean all that," and Rand's like, "No, I didn't mean it. I thought I was in trouble, and you know, maybe I still am, I don't know, but I didn't mean what I said." And then Perrin says, "We will really all go together later," and Rand says, "I can't." Then Perrin walks out and slams the door on him. It's almost like the sense of abandonment is what is so upsetting. They're like, "You can talk shit to us and be all like, people think I'm a lord and you guys are here dicing with stable hands, you fucking nerds. But the fact that you would abandon us and tell us that we can't go with you, that is so offensive and such a betrayal to us." And then Loyal, showing absolutely no sense of being able to read the situation, exacerbates it by saying, "Oh, you guys are Ta'veren, you can't make each other fuck off. The pattern will make you stay together even if you try to get away from each other," which is just the last straw for Matt, who stalks off, dragging Perrin with him, and it says, Rand watched them go with a stick caught in his throat. "I must go alone. Light, help me, I have to." Loyal somehow thinks this is his fault and tries to tell Rand he's sorry, and then Rand blows it up even more by lashing out at him, and then having all of the Shinarans look at him like, "You monster!" And there's just this sense of everything breaking apart. It says, Rand slumped against the stacked sacks of grain. "Well," a voice in his head taunted, "you did it, didn't you?" "I had to," he told it. "I will be dangerous just to be around. Blood and ashes, I'm going to go mad and..." "No, no, I won't. I will not use the power, and then I won't go mad. But I can't risk it. I can't, don't you see? But the voice only laughed at him. This bit of internal taunting that we get, it shows how well RJ understood that mental illness can be subtle. It's not always your brain is super broken because you have a major mood disorder, or you have occasional bouts of psychosis, or the more fantastical, you're doomed to hopeless destructive insanity because of the vile taint of evil from the evilest vileness. We've seen Rand engage in negative self-talk before. He always kind of talks down about himself in a way that the other boys just don't seem to, and while some of that came after Matt picked up the dagger, some of it didn't. I think Rand has always been a bit melancholy. Maybe he never suffered from terrible depression, maybe he struggled in winter when there was less work to do on the farm and less to keep him occupied. Maybe one of the reasons he's so attached to his father is that Tam kept him from being too lost in himself. Regardless, this bit after chasing off his friends is the first time we witness him struggle with an internal voice where he's actually talking to him about it. Egwene hears from Matt and Perrin about Rand's tantrum, and she goes looking for him. He comes across her in the storerooms, and it says, at the sight of her, sadness and loss rolled over him, worse than when he had chased Matt and Perrin and Loyal away. He had grown up thinking he would marry Egwene one day. They both had. But now... She basically takes him to task for telling his friends off and being a dick to her. And it's like, you're basically just trying to push everybody away because you're afraid you're going to go crazy and hurt people. And she's naive enough to think that he can choose not to channel. But when she hears about the Ammerlin and that Lon said that it would have been better for Rand to have been gone a week ago... She says, why should the Ammerlin or any Aes Sedai but Moraine even know you exist? For a moment he stared at her. The longer that she spent with Moraine and Nynaeve, the more she took on their manner, at least when she wanted to. They were much alike at times, the Aes Sedai and the wisdom, distant and knowing. It was disconcerting coming from Egwene. Finally he told her what Lon had said. What else could he mean? Her hand froze on her arm and she frowned with concentration. Moraine knows about you, and she hasn't done anything, so why should she now? But if Lon... Still frowning, she met his eyes. The storerooms are the first place they will look, if they do look. Until we find out if they are looking, we need to put you somewhere they would never think of searching. I know, the dungeon. He scrambled to his feet. The dungeon? Not in a cell, Cilia. I go there some evenings to visit Pad and Fane. Nynaeve does, too. No one will think it odd if I go early today. In truth, with everybody looking to the Ammerlin, no one will even notice us. Robert Jordan establishes Egwene's partialness for Fane in Book 1, and it makes sense that she would have known Fane fairly well because he came into the village every year, and she worked at the inn because she was the innkeeper's daughter, and from a pretty young age she would have started serving at table or running errands, and because she was precocious and interested in the outside world, she would have asked him tons of questions, and because he was loquacious and would have liked showing off his knowledge to a kid, he would have liked the attention, and he would have talked to her a whole bunch and been funny and charming. And that would be the reason why when Tom comes out of the Wine Spring Inn and says, oh, I thought I recognized Pad and Fane in there. He was always wanting to bring bad news. There's more raven in him than man. She gets pissed, and she defends him to Tom. So it's a really simple, logical relationship, and it's honestly a great way to set up Matt's encounter with him so that he can steal the dagger. Rand still feels responsible for Egwene's safety, so he's just outraged that she's visiting Fane. You know, which makes sense. The dude brought the Trollocs to their village, and he's been hunting Rand for the Dark One, and that makes it really personal in a way that it isn't quite for Egwene. Egwene just sees someone who doesn't want to be a dark friend anymore. She has no idea, none of them do at that point, that Mordith has consumed part of Fane. When she takes Rand to the dungeon, and then Fane is just much, much worse than he's ever been before, in the dark, chuckling that Mordith knows more than all of you, which, yeah, that's creepy. Regardless, she's always wanting to think that things aren't as dangerous as they are, or aren't as dangerous for her. She has a recklessness that's closer to Matt's. She doesn't quite have the sense of self-preservation that Rand or Perrin do. But she also is just willing to take the kind of risks that would be considered more normal for a man to take, and for Rand, that's just not something a woman should do in the Two Rivers. And Egwene isn't interested in his opinion about what she should do. She's just like, Padden Fain's in a fucking cage, shut up. So Egwene takes Rand to her room instead, and he takes a nap, and she goes, she gathers up Matt, because she decides, okay, well, he doesn't have a totally unfair point, so I'll find one of the other boys. And she generally does try to find people to go with her when she goes, whether she brings Nynaeve, she's brought Perrin before. We get that from Perrin's narrative when he says that the one time that he went into the dungeon with her, the smell of Fain made his hair stand on end, and he wanted to leap through the bars and tear the guy to pieces, and that scared the shit out of him. So when Rand names the Dark One, and the alarm bells in the keep coincidentally go off, which is totally a coincidence, he freaks out because he's just sort of like, I named the Dark One, and everything that happens that's bad is supposed to just hurt me, and Egwene is in the dungeon, and I have to go and save her. One of the things that makes The Great Hunt such an interesting, like, step up in books is that it has some just intense horror scenes in the beginning of the book. It is fucked up. It's a fucked up book. What I like about how this dungeon scene is executed is it's a really smart way to show us some horrible stuff with some main characters in danger while sparing them more trauma than they can handle. So it's just like, let's deal them some blows to the head that will rob them of their short-term memory so they don't have to know all of the shit that happened. They don't have to know. They'll know that it all went down, but they don't remember it. And that's a good thing, because they don't need to remember it. When Rand asks Egwene how she's doing when he's saying goodbye to her, she's thinking that considering what she'd been told, that she was glad that she didn't remember. Which, she's smart, too. The invasion of the keep exposed Rand to people dying by violence for the first time. And that's bad. And I think that it just kind of fits the whole mood with his just general depression and just the whole tone of The Great Hunt. It's like Rand's internal sadness and struggle, and then just like horror and the loss of hope with the horn being stolen, and then believing that if it gets blown for the dark, that the heroes will come and fight for the Dark One because they think that that's a thing. And then the scene in the dungeon is so horrific, it's just extra. And then he gets Fain's really fucked up and disturbing note. And he goes to use the straw and he's like scrubbing it clean. And he gets attacked by Leandrin. And it's like, dude, I'd wipe it off too. You know, nobody wants a private note written in blood out where anyone can read it. And that's fucked up. It's like, it's my private love note, Leandrin. You don't need to read it. It's private. Don't need to be jabbing your ice needles of the One Power in my head because you think you deserve to read my mail. Fuck off. Fortunately, Moraine comes to the rescue and interrupts whatever bullshit Leandrin had planned, and I'm wondering how she knew to come to the dungeon. And it's almost so obvious that Moraine emotionally abandoning him is part of a scheme. I mean, you know that already because she's told Swan. She's purposely let Rand think that she's not interested anymore, but it's like, taking care of Matt and Egwene, she's perfectly kind to Rand. He's freaked out about his friends, and she doesn't spend a lot of time talking to him or anything, but she is perfectly nice to him, because he's not trying to get anything out of her at the time. It's like, we're distracted by his friends, and after they're lifted out on their stretchers, he's just kind of standing around the dungeon with this just horrible horror scene on display with guards' heads on the table and bloody lumps of flesh everywhere and the two prisoners, one of them has hanged himself and the other one has gone insane, and a distressed Inktar has just told him that the horn has been stolen and he doesn't even know what to do with himself because he's still in hiding mode. And all of his stuff is in Egwene's room, and he has no way to get back into the women's apartments now. And then Lon approaches him and says, Moraine sent me to tell you. You can leave any time you want to, even right now. Moraine had Agilmar exempt you from the order. Why now and not earlier? Why couldn't I leave before? Was she the one who had the gates barred then? Ingtar said he knew nothing about any order to keep people in before tonight. Rand thought the warder looked troubled, but all he said was, "When someone gives you a horse, sheepherder, don't complain that it isn't as fast as you'd like." What about Egwene? And Matt? Are they really all right? I can't leave until I know they're all right. The girl is fine. She'll wake up in the morning and probably not even remember what happened. Blows to the head are like that. What about Matt? The choice is up to you, sheepherder. You can leave now or tomorrow or next week. It's up to you. He walked away, leaving Rand standing there in the corridor deep under Faldara Keep. I'm wondering what the point of that was. To tell him, hey, you can go now. Is it reverse psychology again? She doesn't need to use reverse psychology to keep him there with the keep locked down. I think that denying him contact or interaction as a matter of reverse psychology in order to keep him in the keep was one thing. But she did not want Sawan to come. She wasn't happy when she showed up and brought all of these other Aes Sedai. I'm wondering if she's giving him a heads up so he can avoid the bushwhacking that he's subjected to the next day because he chooses not to leave in time and so he gets called and summoned before the Amyrlin seat. I'm wondering if she wasn't best pleased by how they did that. Maybe sending Lon to tell Rand that he could go was her trying to give him a heads up so he could get out. In the scene where they tell him that he's the Dragon Reborn, before they get to actually telling him the bad news, they push him off balance. They work to make him uncomfortable. They talk about him as if he's not there, and then they get into a discussion about his sword. In answer to Swan asking how he came by the sword, Moraine mentions that his dad was a soldier in Ilion. She has information about his father that she never gave to him before, so he's automatically riled up and upset about that, and then Swan deliberately tries to piss him off by telling Varen to take his sword and test it to see if it's power rot. And leading up to that, we get, after he kneels and then stands before the Amyrlin and meets her eye to eye, "Sit, boy," she said finally, as if he's a dog, gesturing to a ladder-backed chair that had been pulled around squarely in front of the table. "This will not be short, I fear." "Thank you, mother." He bowed his head, then, as Lon had told him, glanced at the chair and touched his sword. "By your leave, mother, I will stand. The watch is not done." The Amyrlin seat made an exasperated sound and looked at Moraine. "Have you let Lon at him, daughter? This will be difficult enough without him picking up waterways." "Lon has been teaching all the boys, mother," Moraine replied calmly. "He has spent a little more time with this one than the others because he carries a sword." I think the relationship between Rand and Moraine is an example of the struggle between the relationship that you want with someone versus the relationship that you need. Rand is from a warm, homey, and loving background. He has a very warm and open relationship with his father. The people from the Two Rivers, even if they don't talk to each other very openly, even if their communication skills aren't that great, they don't fuck with each other's heads. They don't play mind games. Moraine is a soldier. If she had given him the time that he was wanting to talk it out and feel his feelers and have his difficulties, he has so many difficulties, and the world can't afford to wait. I think she has to have this much more heartless, suck it up, you're in the army now, approach. It's certainly debatable, but I almost feel like Moraine is quietly advocating for Rand. She's not sorry that he can stand up for himself, and as much as she would like him to listen to her without giving her any back talk, I think the fact that he's resistant here to the Amyrlin has to be a relief in a way, since the arrival of the Amyrlin was proof that everything had slipped out of her control and she was not happy about all of that. So the fact that Rand could stand up for himself a bit and not be pushed around, I kind of feel like Moraine knows that he needs to be out in the world, just working on it and affecting it and letting Tavirin stir the pot. She knows that already, which is why she even said to Swan, "I can't stay with him. Back before the horn got stolen and the plan was still to have him take it to Ilion, she was like, he needs to go to Ilion alone and I'll be there at the time that he's going to present it to the Council of Nine. So you know, she needs to go do some research, and she also knows that he just needs to be out on his own, doing his dragon thing, doing his Tavirin thing, and affecting the world. And so I think she's pleased that Swan can't push him around, because if there is anyone who can push people around, it's Swan. And the fact that Rand stands up to her, I think, makes Moraine happy, and stands up to her pretty effortlessly. I mean, she rocks him emotionally, but there's never a chance that he's going to bend before her for a second. And though I think Moraine might feel a little bit bad that they pull this dickish ambush on him, because she's not a mean person, and she knows that Rand is just a kid, she's realistic enough to know that what must be, must be. The dragon must be a leader. And since the dragon isn't having any of it right now, she's gonna have to be sneaky to make that happen. And so she and Swan tell Agamar and Inktar that Rand is to be his second, and she takes the opportunity to pack up his new clothes. He stalks off and goes and finds Egwene to say goodbye, and she makes sure that all of his non-fancy clothes are cleared out of his wardrobe so that there's nothing more appropriate for him to change into. He's still wearing his fancy red coat, and Matt sneers at it. It says, on returning to his room, he had found everything already packed and sent on. All of the plain coats he had been given were on the pack horses, so the servants said. Every coat left in the wardrobe was at least as ornate as the one that he wore. It's a lie that his plain coats are on the pack horses. Moraine saw to his packing and made sure that he had no choice but to wear finery. And she was probably, the whole time that he was in Faldara, subtly encouraging the rumors of his nobility in the keep. She figured that the sooner that he got used to it, the better. Maybe she chose not to talk to him because there just wasn't enough time. Maybe the first oath would create conflict. She couldn't be straightforward to his face while manipulating him behind his back. Even with all of his anger and resentment and hurt, when Rand faces real trouble, when he falls into Fane's trap, when they're at the windmill village where the Fade is killed, he wants Moraine's guidance. They reach their campsite in the portal stone hollow, and Rand is spacing out mid-dismount. He's standing there with one foot in the stirrup, thinking about the Fade that Fane nailed to the door, and about stepping into that dining room and seeing all the people playing in that loop and all the flies flying around. It says, even more than the Fade nailed to the door, he wanted to forget that room, and the flies, and the people who were there and not there. The Half-Men had been real. Everybody had seen that. But the room, maybe I'm finally going mad. He wished Moraine was there to talk to. Wishing for an Aes Sedai. You are a fool. You're well out of that. Now stay out. But am I out? What happened there? So she answers no questions, because she has no real answers, and nothing she can tell him will make him feel better or will fix anything, and so she's not going to waste her breath. She gives him what tools she can. She gives him some fancy coats. She tries to enforce the idea that he's a lord because it will be useful for him later, and she gives him his banner and tells him that his life might depend on it, and then just throws him into the water to sink or swim. If Rand would have accepted that he was the chosen one without trouble, she could have shown him more warmth and encouragement, I think. It's kind of like with Harry Potter. Fuck you, J.K. Rowling. Harry Potter was able to accept that he was the chosen one, no problem. So he and Dumbledore have this kind of warm rapport because he knows that he's destined to fight Voldemort. And so it's just kind of like Dumbledore can be his warm mentor and they can have that pleasant relationship. But Rand fights and struggles against it, and is someone who's so willfully stubborn and obtuse and does not want to be the dragon. He does not want to accept that. There was just no time to sweet-talk him, and the world would have burned to the ground while he was still halfway to acceptance. So I look at Moraine dealing with Rand, and honestly, I see, as much as I judge all of the dumb choices that she makes, because I sort of think about him reaching out to her, wanting her help. I want to be like, okay, kiddo, what do you need? You know, what can I help you with? Not even thinking about the fact that Rand is facing problems that you really can't help with. I always told my kid, please don't make any mistakes I can't help you fix. That's all I ask. Well, being the dragon reborn and doomed to go insane and die horribly because you can channel the tainted male half of the One Power, that's not technically a mistake, but it's something that you can't help someone fix. And so I guess that's beyond my ability to judge at that point. And I look at Moraine dealing with Rand, and at this point I'm kind of seeing a parallel right now to life in the time of COVID, where every single choice that you make is wrong. Every option you have has a shitty outcome, you know. Do I send my kids to school? That's really not a great choice. That's not a great thing to do. Do I keep them home? That's not really great either. Do I hide indoors while the economy tanks? Do I try to do life and hope nobody dies from my carelessness? Nothing right now that any of us are choosing to do. None of us have good choices right now, particularly depending upon our level of privilege. And so I've come to the conclusion that Moraine's position is one where, no matter what she does, a person on the outside looking in can reasonably say, that was dumb. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcasts of the Dragon. I've really enjoyed these episodes I've done at the beginning of the Great Hunt, and now I'm ready to skip to the middle of it. I've got a really cool episode planned next, and that's all I'm going to say about it. You can find me on Twitter at Warder Gray. That's Gray with an E. You should click the link to my Discord there. I've got a channel there for other Watt content creators. You should look at the Watt fandom and calendar. That will take you to a million other content creators. You should look at Watt trivia and games. There's a whole bunch of cool games that you can look at. You should check out Watt trivia, obviously. You should also look at Watt 20 questions. They have a high fantasy football league. That's really neat. You can email me at podcastofthedragon@gmail.com. My music is by Kevin McLeod. I'm the Grey Warder, and if I were Rand and I wanted Moraine to pay attention to me, I'd just stand outside the women's apartments and hold my flute over my head so she'd know that she was the resolution to all my fruitless searches.